Welcome, welcome to the NPR Movie Podcast, your weekly roundup of NPR's love for the movies. This week, NPR critic Bob Mondello weighs in on the Oscar nominations and their effects on box office takes. Critic Kenneth Turan reviews a small film worthy of big attention. And director Steven Soderbergh talks about his new film, Che. But first, we'll check in with the guy who did the way cool music for the film Slumdog Millionaire.
Name a few musicians who've sold more than 100 million albums. Elvis? Yeah, sure. The Beatles? Absolutely. Here's one to add to your list. A.R. Rahman. Rahman composed the music for more than 130 films in India. And yes, he has sold over 100 million records worldwide. But here in America, many are hearing his music for the first time in the smash hit film Slumdog Millionaire. This is a song called Jai Ho from A.R. Rahman's score to Slumdog Millionaire. He's already picked up a Golden Globe for his work, and he's up for 3 Oscars next month. A.R. Rahman joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks for stopping by.
My pleasure.
This film has taken everyone in America by surprise with its success. How about you? Are you surprised to be winning major awards here in the United States?
It's a big surprise. I think I never even thought about awards when I did this movie. It was just, I just wanted to get away from what I was doing and I just wanted to have fun.
Well, when I think about this music and what you've done with it, all the hooks in it, I mean, it grabs me in so many ways. It's impossible to sit still.
I was very clear that nobody would understand most of the lyrics in Hindi. So I need to have certain kind of syllables which would attract any audience and they could sing. So Jai Ho also came in that way. It means be victorious. It's like a blessing. And it also could be pronounced very easily where any audience could sing that.
A little background from you. You sort of came of age, I guess, with the whole curve of Bollywood music, haven't you?
My first movie, which I did in 91, called Roja, was the turning point in my musical career.
How old were you then?
I was, I think, 23, 24 or something. Mm-hmm. And that got me a national award, and which was, I was really surprised at that time that usually national award comes to people who are really old and about to die. And so people said that, don't you think that it's too early for you and don't you think that you lose your motivation in life? So I think music, in my opinion, is not about motivation in a way. It's not a running race. It's art. And my whole philosophy of music is different. It's almost like cooking and serving to people, seeing them smile and enjoying the food in a way.
Well, you talked a moment ago about wanting to sort of almost like cook for people, and you're known for combining these wonderful eclectic forms of music, reggae, Brazilian drumming. Did you feel you wanted to deliberately expand upon traditional styles?
No, at the time when I was composing, it was all very regional and folk and classical, Indian classical. So young kids were listening to other stuff, which they love, like, you know, Western bands or Arabic stuff or stuff, and then they were neglecting film music. So since I was doing a film, I said, why can't film music have this? It'd be cool for me to listen to in the car. And I didn't want to do movies. I just wanted to do that one movie and get out. So it started like a joke and it became like a bread and butter.
I wanted to ask you, A.R. Rahman, Bollywood is known for churning out movies, and you have been a pillar for the Indian film industry. You've scored dozens and dozens of films. Do you work very quickly?
In India, I'm the slowest compared to other composers. Like, some of the composers have done 30 movies, 25 movies a year. And when I came and I started doing a movie for 6 months, and people said, this guy won't survive, he's too slow for the industry. So, but I wanted to enjoy my process, yeah.
I'd like to talk about directors. What was your approach with Danny Boyle on Slumdog? Would he show you the rushes each day, or did he say, here's the script, score me something that shows, you know, the principal actor trying to answer a question? How does that collaboration work?
Yeah, what happened was, he sent me the script on email before, but I couldn't read it. And when I met him, he had a copy of the DVD, a very basic cut. And I took it home and watched it, and I was really excited. I thought it was a fabulous movie. Then I started sending him ideas on email, and he would respond to it, like, I like number one and number three, number four, so things like that. Every day he would meet for an hour, like from 7 to 8 in the evening after he finished editing. And then like that, 2 weeks we worked and we finished the whole score.
In 2 weeks?
The whole thing was done in probably 2-3 weeks, yeah.
Wow. Are there any other cuts on this CD that you'd like to talk about?
There's one song called Mawsam and Escape, which is, there's a sitar player, and sitar for me is a could get very sad when they play, but here it's a completely radically different use, and I really love the track.
Did you have two sitars, or were you layering it somehow, or what's going on here? What am I hearing?
Some of them are layered, actually. So that's almost like the pulse which keeps going on, and that's why we didn't use the traditional, you know, tambourines and all the stuff.
This seems like a studio-created piece. You couldn't do this live, could you?
We could do it with a lot of electronic loops and stuff, but yeah. Most of my shows are like with 70-80 people on stage.
Yeah.
Since I do film repertoire stuff, it varies. Like sometimes I have this whole string section, and we have this dance, like 20 dancers on stage, and all kinds of ethnic instruments, and 12 to 18 singers coming, all superstar singers from India.
Well, as I mentioned, you've collected 3 Oscar nominations, and 2 of them are for Best Song. At the Academy Awards ceremony in 3 weeks, are you going to get 70 people up on stage performing some of your music?
No, I don't think I can afford that.
How about you? Will you be up on stage performing?
Well, I think they're still a bit unsure about what is going to happen because of various reasons. So we'll be informed very soon.
I can't imagine they're going to turn you down. A.R. Rahman composed the score to Slumdog Millionaire, and he joined us from the studios of NPR West. Mr. Rahman, congratulations. Truly, it's fantastic to talk to you, and we wish you very good luck on the Oscars.
Thank you.
That flurry of Oscar nominations paid off for Slumdog Millionaire, artistically, to be sure, but also where it really counts in Hollywood, and of course, that's at the box office. Last weekend, the movie soared into the top 5 on the weekly box office charts for the first time. That's partly because of those 10 nominations it got, and also because theater owners had bet big on what's called the Oscar bump, more than doubling the number of screens showing Slumdog. Our movie maven, Bob Mondello, is here to break down the bump, which bets paid off, which didn't. Sounds like we're going skiing. Hi, Bob.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So I understand the inauguration also had an impact on the bets this year.
That's right, and that's because the nominations are usually announced on a Tuesday, but this year there was an inauguration that got in the way, and while politics doesn't very often interfere with what Hollywood's doing, this time they decided to bow to President Obama. And so what they did was they announced them on Thursday. Well, that doesn't give the theater owners enough time to book pictures for Friday. So they had to guess as to what was going to win Oscar nominations.
So they had to actually use their imaginations. How'd those guesses pan out?
Well, pretty badly in some cases. A lot of people guessed that The Dark Knight, the Batman movie, was going to get nominated because everybody was talking about how it was almost guaranteed to be nominated for Best Picture. It did not get a nomination. And so 350 theaters book it, and it didn't do very well. And then a lot of people guessed Revolutionary Road, which was, again, supposed to do really well at the top end of the Oscar nominations, and it didn't. And it raised theaters a lot, but it's per theater average, in other words, how much it takes in it on each screen, mm-hmm. went way down, basically, because it did not get the nominations. And so not everybody succeeded with this.
All right. Well, I've got the envelope right here, and I'm going to ask you which films got the biggest Oscar bump.
Well, predictably enough, it was all the ones that actually got nominated for Best Picture. Slumdog did really well, as we've said. It doubled the number of theaters, and it did not dilute the audience per theater very much. Benjamin Button went up slightly, but it's getting played out now. Frost Nixon went from 100 theaters to 1,000 and halved its per theater take. Milk and The Reader did okay. The Reader actually, 50 theaters dropped it because it wasn't expected to get nominated for Best Picture. And so its per screen average went way up, and the theaters that dropped it must be feeling really stupid at the moment.
Can you rebook then?
I assume they will this week. I predict it will go up markedly.
So beyond Best Picture, do Best Actress and Actor nominations also make a difference? It seems as if they do.
They make a slight difference. Doubt got lots of those acting nominations and went up slightly per screen. The Wrestler went wide and its average dropped a little bit. Yes, it helps, but it doesn't help nearly as much as Best Picture.
I know there are people that can do this much better than I, but what's the lesson that we draw from all this?
Well, I think basically it is that Oscars are really only designed to punch up box office. They're a device for publicity for major movies. The Hollywood studios spend a lot on these prestige movies that they don't really expect to do all that well at the box office, and then they give themselves awards for having been so brilliant, and that is supposed to pump up the box office, and it usually does. Interestingly, they've been timing it differently lately because movies earn so much more money very quickly in theaters these days that they've moved the Oscar nominations closer and closer to the end of the year, and they've moved the show itself closer and closer to the Oscar nomination. So there's a shorter window. The bump has to happen very quickly.
Sounds like a big bump. You know, there should be a new category, the Cash Box Award, because of all these searching Oscar favorites, the reigning number one film right now isn't any of them. It's Paul Blart Mall Cop, one of the worst reviewed films and movies, according to people like you.
Well, that's true. And it not only was it not well reviewed, but it stayed at number one for 2 weeks running now. The rule of thumb in January is that any picture that gets up there is going to stay there because everything else that comes out against it is going to be worse than it is. So that's basically what's happening. It'll stay up for a couple of weeks, and then it will fade away into
the sequel.
Maybe not. Yeah, that's probably true. Isn't that sad? Yes.
Well, Bob Mondello, you remain our movie champ. You could have been a contender. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much.
While you're waiting to see which motion pictures win the Oscars this year, maybe you'd like to see a movie that's not exactly Oscar caliber. If so, film critic Kenneth Turan says he's got just the one for you, opening this weekend.
Taken is a brisk and violent action film that can't help being unintentionally silly. It's all about an innocent American teen abducted in Paris by a completely ruthless gang of Albanian white slavers. And would you believe that the only person who has the skills and the moxie to have even a chance of bringing her back alive is her divorced dad? He starts by giving the bad news to his ex-wife and her new husband.
She's been taken.
What are you talking about?
Any enemies overseas, Stuart?
Why would I have any enemies?
Because you do business overseas through multiple shell corporations. Because you were involved in an oil deal with a bunch of Russians that went south 5 years ago.
How the hell do you know about that?
Because I was not going to let my daughter live with someone without knowing everything about them.
That's Irish actor Liam Neeson as the tough dad. Larger than life at 6'4" and an actor who wears his heart on his sleeve, Neeson throws himself into the role of Brian Mills, ex-CIA, making good use of a purposeful scowl that combines fury with disgust. He certainly has a lot to scowl about. Mills is retired now, spending lonely nights consuming takeout Chinese food because he wants to get closer to his daughter and make up for years of separation. But as Mills himself says, I'm retired, not dead. And when his daughter and a friend get abducted by those amoral Albanians, he springs into action.
If you're looking for ransom, I can tell you I don't have money. But what I do have,
are a very particular set of skills. Skills I've acquired over a very long career. Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
Mills always puts evil in its place, whether it's a horde of virginity-despoiling Arabs, some stereotypes simply refuse to die, or that unpleasant gang of marauding Albanians. Innocent people do get shot in the process, but hey, no one said this was going to be easy. Mills leaves an innocent friend bleeding on the floor and tells her husband, "Tell your wife I apologize." And they say that chivalry is dead.
The movie is Taken. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times, and we review more of the current movies at npr.org.
Director Steven Soderbergh turns out about a movie a year, from Sex Lies and Videotape to Aaron Brockovich to Ocean's 11, 12, 13. Now he's focused his lens on the iconic revolutionary Che Guevara, played in the new movie Che by Benicio del Toro.
Let me tell you something at the risk of sounding ridiculous. A true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. Love of humanity, of justice and truth.
The movie is an epic, two parts, each more than 2 hours long. The first film shows Che meeting Fidel Castro in Mexico, then becoming a hero of the Cuban Revolution. We also see Che Guevara on a visit to New York in 1964 to speak to the UN. Protesters pound the windows of his car, shouting, "Assassin, get out of Cuba." Then we see Che being fawned over at a cocktail party of the intellectual elite.
Sir, would the Comandante object to giving me his autograph?
That's part one. Part two shows Che Guevara's doomed campaign to bring revolution to Bolivia, where he was captured and executed. Director Steven Soderbergh says he went back to interview people who fought with Che or worked with Che to find illuminating details.
I wasn't looking for big stuff. I was looking for small stuff, like the scene where he's asked if he wants any powder on his face before he goes on TV, and he says no, and then he sees somebody else getting powder, and he says, yes, I'd like a little. You know, that was a story that we got from his translator, and those are the kind of things I was looking for.
What was it about those small moments?
It just made him human scale, and so I was trying to avoid the sort of traditional big scenes or the sense that any of them realize what role they're playing in history. I wanted the whole thing to be happening in a very naturalistic way, because I don't think until very late in the campaign in Cuba that they really understood the significance of what was happening.
Yeah, it's funny, because if we think of him as, you know, that iconic image on the T-shirt, how do you make that human? How do you get him out of that T-shirt and into something that's more real?
Yeah, well, I think part of the way to do that, for instance, in the opening of part one, is to both show him arriving in New York sort of in his rock star phase and at the height of his notoriety and fame, and contrasting that with him lost in the Cuban jungle suffering from asthma, and having the audience sort of see those two images alongside each other and wonder how they're going to converge.
As you know, the main controversy over the film is what's left out, the mm-hmm. period after the Cuban Revolution, when Che Guevara is the prison commander in Havana and there are executions, purges of opponents. That is not told explicitly in the movie. It's not shown in the movie.
Well, but that's what New York is.
This is Che's visit to New York in 1964.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, is he's here on his little junket, and everywhere he goes, people are calling him a murderer and an assassin. And in his speech at the UN, he talks about that. This was my version of handling that. It's obviously not going to satisfy people who define him entirely by that period, but that's my way of handling it. And I think anybody who looks at the thing from a certain distance can see that my choice to show these two campaigns is driven more by artistic needs than it is by political agenda. You know what I mean? I wanted to make a sort of a diptych where these two campaigns sort of talked back and forth to each other. So the center section there between those two campaigns just didn't fit what I wanted to do artistically.
Does it run the risk, though, of becoming hagiography to show just those
You know, it doesn't to me. I don't know. It doesn't really matter to me. I mean, by definition, in making the film, I have to tell it from his perspective. I'm telling his story, not mine, because obviously I don't believe everything that he believes, but I'm making a movie about a believer, and there's a big difference between those two. For instance, if I made a movie about John Wilkes Booth and I put you in his experience, that doesn't mean I support the idea of shooting Lincoln. But my job as a filmmaker is to put you in his skin.
When you're working on a movie like this, two movies, 4 hours, controversial historical figure, how much are you thinking, will audiences like it? Will it sell? Or do you just leave that to, you know, Oceans 19, 20, and 21 to take care of?
No, I mean, I have the same question no matter what the movie is. And the answer is I can only make something that I would want to see, that I would stand in line and pay money for. If that's not my criteria, then I'm second-guessing myself, and I think that way lies madness.
And does it feel like a very different enterprise shooting? I mean, it sounds obvious that it would, shooting a movie like this, creating a movie like this, and, say, Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13.
No, I have to say the problem-solving aspect of it is pretty similar. And so for me, whether it's a Che or an Ocean's film or a tiny thing I did called Bubble a couple of years ago, the only difference is the number of people standing around. But the problem on a day-to-day level of how to make scenes work is the same.
Really?
Yeah. I promise.
Even if one is a caper and the other's a...
Well, I mean, there's more... You're probably telling more jokes on the set of Oceans than you are on Che. But, you know, there are times when there's fun to be had even on a very serious movie.
What was the most fun on this one?
What? You mean, was there any fun on
yeah,
this one?
Well, maybe I should rephrase
no,
that.
No, not really. Not really. It was, like I said, happening so fast. And you had to be careful, too. I mean, there were guns going off and bombs blowing up. I mean, you had to be very, very focused to make sure that everything was going safely, at least.
I was watching a clip on YouTube of a Q&A you had after a screening in New York.
Yeah.
And the audience is very divided, and you hear somebody shouting out about Che. He's a murderer.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's 40 years ago. You have this scene in your movie. It's the same thing that happened when he went to New York.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, I like when art can do that. I like when art is about something or is been made in such a way that gets people animated like that. I think that's terrific. It doesn't happen very much. I think it used to happen more. When you hear about Stravinsky playing The Rite of Spring for the first time and there was a riot in the concert hall, I mean, that's kind of cool.
So that was a good thing. Didn't look like you were having a good time at the time.
But. No, but, you know, it's still interesting. I remember the filmmaker Jean Renoir made a film called Rules of the Game, which when it was premiered in France was very, very controversial. And he describes watching a man tear his newspaper into strips and light it on fire. The guy hated the movie so much he wanted to burn the theater down. I just thought, wow, that's awesome.
That did not happen in New York, we should say.
No. It's, you know... I guarantee you, if the Q&A at the Ziegfeld that turned into anarchy had happened after Bush had dodged the shoes, then I'd be pretty bruised right now.
Well, Steven Soderbergh, it's good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You can hear these stories and more on our website, npr.org/movies.